All right, welcome back. Nice to see everyone. So I'd like to do a recap from last week's talk around climate change. And I was reflecting on this, you know, why is, you know, the issues around climate crisis, climate change, so still so difficult for us to really handle, to take care of. And I'd say what came to mind was around the sense of connection or the lack of connection, particularly with the natural world. So I remember when I was a young child being very, feeling very connected to nature, liking to spend times alone out in the, just walking around the block or even going up into the woods of New Mexico, the high altitude woods, and just enjoying those ponderosa forests and just the sense of aloneness and yet connection with nature. And I, as I reflect back, a lot of that was just the sense of not being, being completely accepted by the natural environment. You know, and then that was such a relief of those young years and that sense of, you know, the angst as a teenager. And became my first career choice is to spend time in the woods as a wilderness ranger, where I learned even, you know, more how to care for the lands. And some of the areas that we patrol frequently became like places of connection and home. And yet we can go into something that's very beautiful, you know, beautiful environment, you know, deep, beautiful vistas, beautiful lakes, and still feel that sense of lack of connection, that disconnection. And I think if, as we look, we may see that actually that deep sense of inconnection, lack of connection starts with ourselves. And we don't have that connection with ourselves, that sense of deep friendliness, that deep allowance for who we are, what we are, moment by moment. And that inner disconnection then naturally translates out into the natural environment, how we relate to nature. I think this lack of connection is one of the reasons why we still are delaying the actions that we need to do around climate change and the climate crisis and that lack of connection. Because we think about connection, we can see it as an expression of wise view. Right? So wise view is understanding deeply the nature of what causes dukkha, what causes suffering, and the cessation of that suffering. You know, the deep origin of that. And one way we can really frame that is when we believe in an isolated sense of self, a disconnected sense of self that's having its own, you know, isolated experience. That's what creates the suffering. Another way to say it is that sense of personalization that, okay, I'm having this experience and you're having a different experience. And that you know, it certainly has its utility, but that basic stance is one of separation. And through practice, we can start to see through that, to start to see the deep connection underneath all of that, the deep lack of separation. And when that sense of connection, of interconnection, of unity is felt internally, it naturally goes out into the world. And so with something like climate change, learning to really connect with that the environment, connect with the sense of nature, you know, how it's a precious thing. Of course, back when I was a ranger, you could see that, you know, the effects of someone's being connected or not connected very directly, very immediately by the scars they would leave on the land or the damage they would cause. And those who are connected, you know, they could see the sense of harmony, the sense of low impact camping that would arise, or the sense of leaving no trace. With climate change, we struggle because it seems so far removed. You know, how does my action today affect something so big as the climate? And even going into how many years till it becomes unavoidable to really perceive that, to really see the changes. It's like there's a separation of time and space with that. So all these are just ways we have to kind of navigate through this climate crisis to start to understand, you know, how connected we are and how if we harm ourselves, if we, it's the same thing as harming the environment. So last week I talked about wise intention as kind of a gateway into looking at the Dharma implications of climate crisis. And again, wise intention starts with wise view, that sense of interconnection. So when that interconnection is present, wise intention naturally flows from that. We naturally flow from a sense of renunciation, of non-ill will, and non-harm. And when we come from a sense of separation, then it's much easier to come from that place of disconnect, that sense of really acting from greed, acting from our desires, acting in a way based in harm, acting in a way that's based in ill will. So let's just touch upon these three wise intentions and how they can relate to the climate crisis. So the first one of renunciation. So renunciation is really about letting go of, you know, our greed, our letting go of our impulse to always seek. We can feel that inner lack that's so often driving that. There's something fundamentally missing in me. If I look closely, and if I just can gain that. And nature has been such a place that we've taken. You know, we've taken from, you know, from the land in so many different ways, you know, and how we exploit it. On the other hand, when we come from a sense of interconnection, then there's that inner sufficiency that's already there. And we're much more likely to renounce actions which really don't, that cause more harm, that cause that we're taking from something that's not freely given. So that sense of renunciation when it comes to the climate crisis, I think we all looked at those list of actions that we can do. And some of those actions, you know, we're already doing. You know, we should feel good about that and reflect on how that's really a gift to the world, gift to future generations, even our next generation, even ourselves, depending on how old we are. And we also see some of those items in those lists that create a sense of, oh, that's a little too much, or I'm not quite willing to take that step. I like that part. And that's a beautiful time to bring the Dharma practice to bear. To say, okay, let me unpack that resistance. What does that resistance really feel like? Where is it oriented as a body experience? What's kind of the deeper stance around it, the beliefs around it? And often we come into kind of butt up against, you know, to lack of a better word, that quality of greed. So greed's kind of a heavy word to use, but it's one of the fundamental kleshas or defilements, one of the basic expressions of ignorance. And a sense of lack that we're trying to fill. And so when we feel that, we can connect with that sense of separation. And then see if there's some way to find that interconnection that's there underneath this illusion of separation. Because when we connect with that interconnection, when we feel that sense of unity, then renunciation becomes much more natural. It's much more of almost, it releases from us instead of us having this intentional act to let go of something. Like there's this deep release that happens of its own accord. So renunciation, you know, does mean giving up things. You know, there's some things we may have to give up or at least modify or change in order to do our part in protecting the environment. And also, not only our own personal choices, but the choices of our government, of our leadership. You know, how can we have that sense of renunciation to set aside, you know, our own wants for what's best for the planet, best for the world. So renunciation. The second wise intention is that of non-ill will. Non-ill will. Okay, so as we hold that, you know, the opposite of that, of course, is ill will, a sense of of hatred or just attacking, of destroying. And how many of us, go out into our gardens this time of year and perhaps, get rid of pests, things that we don't want, because they don't grow there. They don't look nice in our garden. I'm not saying that's not perhaps the right choice to make, but just to notice the underlying sense of ill will. We see, okay, there's something that's not what we want. It's not here. It's not part of what we consider our, who we are, or what I'm trying to, I'm kind of a little tired this tonight, so I'm kind of stumbling a little bit. When we go out and see that sense of, okay, that weed is there, that dandelion, that doesn't fit into my concept of what the world should be, the natural world should be. So ill will naturally comes out from that. Just trying to trace how that sense of ill will comes from that sense of separation. Okay? So if this isn't part of what I think is my home or the way I want it, then ill will is justified, or so the logic goes. So look at something like climate change, that sense of ill will. So often we pollute the air, pollute, the waters, pollute the land, just because there's a sense of discounting that, not realizing that connection, or feeling that sense the world is so big, it doesn't matter, this one action. So when we find ourselves acting that way, again, the invitation from a dharmic perspective is to learn, is to pause. Actually say, okay, what's present right here in this heart, in this mind? Okay, what's the inclination? What's the intention? What's the driving force behind that action? And even deeper, what's the view that supports that intention? Because we're always operating from some view, whether we're conscious or not. That a view then becomes how we form our intention, which then forms into our actions. We often don't wake up until we're in the middle of an action, or even after we've done something, and realize, oh, that wasn't so kind, or that wasn't so skillful. And we perhaps feel a little bit of remorse or shame. We can step back and say, okay, what was that? What was the intention behind that? And what was the sense of you that was holding that? And just holding it very simply. Was that a sense of connected view or separate view? Connected view leads to that sense of natural non-ill will. Separated view, disconnected view, isolated view leads to that sense of ill will. They just flow naturally from one to the other. And so hopefully as we take this on as a Dharma practice, it starts to translate out into some of those bigger choices in our lives. And hopefully even start to echo out into the world and the way decisions are made. And then finally, the last wise intention is of non-harm. So non-harm has that sense of, again, that sense of when you naturally are connected to something, you don't want to harm it. And when you feel that sense of love, that sense of sameness, that sense of unity, harm doesn't arise. But when there's that sense of separation, this is equally applies to interpersonal, among all the issues around racism, around the environment. All those things arise when we're that sense of separation, when we create the other. And I think that sense of otherness is especially around, let's say around the topic of tonight, climate change, is really focused on that sense of separation, that we don't feel that sense of being at home in the natural world. In the guided meditation, I suggested feeling that sense of environment, sensing the smells, how the temperature of the air, if your eyes are open, sensing the shapes of the things around you, the sounds, right? And since we're all at home, hopefully there's a sense of ease with that location, and the ease with that sense of, okay, this is where I belong. That same quality, we go out into nature and we can hopefully recover that. We're so often removed from nature, sometimes not stepping on the bare earth for months at a time. you're not feeling the, you know, feeling the power of nature that's so, so available if we just open our senses to it. So that sense of disconnection is there. Then, you know, how can we hope to care for the climate? How can we hope to care for the environment? Often we try to through our minds, through that, you know, that intention of the intellect. If we start to feel, okay, the nature is actually, I am part of nature, and nature is part of me. Each one of us is part of that nature. And climate change takes on a whole different meaning, a whole different way of relating. And non-harm, non-ill will, renunciation naturally flow from that. That should become a way, an obvious way of acting in the world. So these three wise intentions of renunciation, of non-ill will, of non-harm, all flow from our view, our wise view. So rediscovering that sense of interconnection and bringing that to bear on the climate crisis, bringing it to bear on how we as individuals and as a community can start to make a difference. All right, thank you for your kind attention, and we'll just sit for a moment or two. All right, so I'd like to invite us to go into some small groups to kind of talk about this topic more individually, or, you know, could have a chance to have your voice heard and to share. So this, you know, this is optional. If you'd rather stay back here in the Mountain Logic group, that's perfectly fine. But you'll find that if you do, those groups are often very nice places to share your experience. In particular, we'll talk about the homework from last week. So going over in your mind a list of climate change actions, and notice which ones might create a sense of resistance in you. When there's resistance is felt, you know, with your group, just you maybe share one of those things like, you know, I really think I don't want to give up flying. I like to fly to visit my grandkids across the country or something like that. So as you feel that, okay, notice, reflect on the resistance, and also where's the sense of intention coming from? You know, where's the sense of view coming from? And is there a way to start to shift that, you know, shift the view and intention so that action might become more accessible? Okay, welcome back. So we have a chance now to, you know, talk about what you explored. Ask any questions around that, or share, like the things you like to share, or if you have other questions about Dharma practice, those are also welcome. And to do this, you can just go ahead and unmute yourself, or you could also raise your virtual hand, or even send a chat, although that's harder for me to read.
So, Tim, this is Iris.
Iris.
Hi. I had the pleasure of being in a room with somebody you know very well. We spoke about a whole bunch of things. One thing that I brought up, and I'd just like to throw it out to our whole group, because I feel like I really need help with trying to figure out how to move forward. Is the idea of educating people, like Seattle citizens, and the need for people to learn about the different aspects of the problem, and then things that we can do to address the problem. And You know, if there could be like public education campaigns or ads on buses or, you know, on the light rail trains or PSAs. So if anyone here on this call, on this Zoom, has experience with running these kinds of campaigns or has any thoughts or ideas about how to move this forward? I mean, street signs about don't idle your car or Meatless Monday or I don't know. I have this big idea, but I can't sort of move it forward yet.
So would it be best for people to contact you through the Climate Action website, Iris?
Sure. Yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
Thank you, Iris. All right, what else might be out there? You guys talked for 20 minutes.
Tim?
Yes, Bob, go ahead.
Our group talked a little bit about sort of relatives versus absolutes. And when you're talking about non-harming and you're talking about whether it's more harmful to leave an aging relative unvisited or to take a plane ride. Do you have anything to say about that sort of relative calculation from a Buddhist perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question that relative harm versus, you know, where's the harm coming in? And it's, we could look at it from the lens of the precepts and how there's this, you know, undertaking the training to refrain from. So if we took that in a very literal absolute standpoint, taking antibiotics when we're sick, brushing our teeth, I mean, those are all forms of killing, you know, but there's the relative benefit of that. So that's kind of an extreme example, but we can see like, okay, you have an aging relative that, you know, it's important to see them. You want to have that connection. And so some of it's learning to kind of offset the impact. Okay. So if I take a flight, can I do something else instead, you know, to kind of make up for that? And a lot of it is really kind of a personal choice. And this is where as a teacher, I try not to be dogmatic. Like this is the way you should act. This is the way you should be in the world, but much more trying to give people the skills to see for themselves, to really empower them to see for themselves and to kind of weigh those two things. You know, okay, there's harm here. Everywhere we go, there's going to be some level of harm if we really look carefully. But see, okay, what's the right balance of that? So it's not, I don't know if that's really a good answer for you, but it's a quandary. It's something to reflect upon, and it may be that some of those harms, like visiting an aging relative, you know, that makes more sense, you know, even though it has its consequences. But maybe taking a vacation when you have other choices, that's a different thing to come to mind. Do you have some follow-up on that, Bob? I don't know if I...
Well, no, I'm just thinking as you're talking about questions of selfing or ego also, and sort of how that might be a measure. And I think about traveling somewhere to learn something new. Is that something that can be, I mean, it's one thing to go on a vacation without really much concern for anyone, but it gets more gray, I think, when you think, well, I'm traveling or whatever to learn something that I might apply.
That's right.
Someone else.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one example is meditation retreats. You know, teachers travel across the country to give retreats, you know, and there's emissions from those travels. And so you have to weigh, okay, going to teach and offering the Dharma, there's the benefit of that, but there's the cost in the environment, you know, going to attend a retreat as a yogi. Yeah. So it's kind of, there's no clear answer, like do this or don't do that. It's kind of weighing that, considering that, you know, there's one technique is to buy what carbon credits to kind of make up for that. You know, that could be one way to work with that dilemma. And that's one way that some Dharma organizations have been playing around that is, okay, we'll buy some carbon credits to try to offset the impact of having yogis and teachers fly to these retreats.
Yeah, I'm just smiling because it's kind of like, put your own mask on first.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I'm curious about what the Buddha might have said in sutras elsewhere about that relativity question. It makes me want to do some research.
Well, from the Buddhist standpoint, he really focused on, does this lead to suffering or not suffering? Okay, so the harm, you know, it was an important aspect of it, but he was particularly concerned with that ultimate sense of liberation or non-liberation, you know, and that was kind of the bottom line for him, you know, for people who are practicing to be free in that way. In terms of lay people, he would talk a lot about, you know, non-harm. That was, particularly with lay people and reflecting on all the different ways of kind of highlighting that. So I think if he really connected with, you know, really saw the impact of climate change and the coming climate crisis, then he would, you know, that he would talk about it in that very clear way.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Bob. All right, Steve, go ahead.
There we go. Yeah. You know, one thing for me the last year and a half or a bit since March, is, you know, the whole aspect of sort of a forced retreat for so many of us because we couldn't go anywhere pretty much. And, you know, I do this Northwest Dharma News thing. So I've got a lot of contact with other Dharma groups all around the region and all over the place. You know, people just pretty much hunkered down, but did all kinds of practice in different ways. And I found myself thinking a lot about, you know, someone like Ajahn Chah the Buddha, he probably traveled in a maybe 400-mile radius in his entire life, or Ajahn Chah pretty much stayed up in Northeast Thailand and they awakened. And whereas, you know, I've done all the traveling, we run around and sort of enjoyment here, enjoyment there, that part of it. It sort of feels, it almost like I recalibrated my sense of focus on the path and kind of dialed back the fun part of travel, because I realized, you know what, I'm really fine without it, and actually can focus more on the path without it. And I was struck how all over the region a bunch of micro decisions are being made along those lines. So, you know, to me, just especially for us practitioners, I think I think a lot of people were less frustrated by the situation than a lot of sort of more worldly people were, because we had a way to turn within and utilize this time. So I'm kind of coming out of this recalibrated. And then also, you know, the weird upside of the technologies. I've done retreats in New Zealand and all kinds of amazing things in the last year, and doesn't have to go anywhere. And I think there's going to be a ton more of that. I think Zoom is here to stay. And, you know, I know Sims is working on hybrid stuff and everybody's doing hybrid stuff. Look, move coming out of the pandemic. So I think that'll dial back the, the fossil fuels aspect of the Dharma quite a bit. So I was just sort of throwing that out there.
Yes. Yeah. I think it definitely the pandemic has really, you know, forced us to have a level of renunciation that, you know, whether we wanted to or not.
Yeah. Right.
You know, things we had to release and let go of that, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, there's trips I had planned that didn't happen because of that. And yeah, am I really ultimately less than because of that?
Exactly.
I think the practice does show that, yeah, there's a sufficiency just right here. And, And hopefully we take that lesson, you know, this point forward. I think it is a big, it's like showing that it's possible. It's possible that we can live much more simply, especially around travel, than we ever have. And as you said, there's a level of connectivity through Zoom that we can access sanghas and teachers around the world.
Yeah. Thank you. Yep. That was kind of the drift. Yep.
Yeah. You know, on this call, we have people from a couple people, at least from California, someone from Portland. You know, that would be a long commute to come up for Monday night.
All right.
Thank you, Steve. All right, what else might be out there in the cyber world? Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a thought at the end of our group, which our group was very, very productive, and I liked it. Myself, I tend to get a little discouraged a lot of the time, or feel like, a sense of hopelessness, like with the recycling, for example, but buying food in plastic packages, because I'm kind of mobility impaired, sending for things on Amazon, and they all come in horrible packages, or, you know, all kinds of things, or just not thinking through sometimes whether I could do without something. I get a little discouraged about it. And I thought then, well, maybe I should watch for the efforts I come up with every day that are successful and start there. Mm-hmm. So maybe try to go more positive. I want to be engaged with this topic. And for me, it might have to start small. Like, I recycled one more thing. Gee, here's a thing I could have bought in a package and I didn't. And just worked my way up.
Yes, yeah, I think that's really a helpful thing to bring up. And, you know, we talked about wise view, wise intention as, you know, folds, you know, parts of the Eightfold Path. We can also, let's talk about wise effort for a moment. And, you know, wise effort, and I think I did speak about that in the addiction talk a few weeks ago. So wise effort is, it kind of asks us to step back and kind of notice what are we generating in this moment? You know, what's our mental shape and mental mind? You know, what's our emotional mind? What's arising in this? And so when that sense of being overwhelmed, being like, I'm helpless here because I have to, you know, I'm relying it upon, you know, shipping because I can't get out to the stores in the same way. You know, it can be that sense of hopelessness if we step back, and so we're not inhabiting that in the same way. We actually step back and see that. That's where wise effort comes in. Okay, there's a mind state that's kind of painful. That's hard to bear, especially something like climate change that can feel overwhelming, can feel like it's beyond my control. You know, what can I do? There's the coal plants spewing out more stuff in a day than I would do in a whole lifetime. And there can be all that stuff that can go through our minds around that. So, but if you step back, we notice, okay, I'm going to that hopeless place. So then wise effort recognizes that. And then how can I bring a sense of balance to that? Remember, wise effort is that sense of releasing what's unwholesome, what's unproductive, what's painful, what's causing suffering. How do you release what's arisen in this moment? You know, and how do you help that not arise? And then the other side of wise effort is something that's wholesome. How do you allow that to arise? So that sense of energy, that sense of optimism, that sense of, okay, I'm going to persevere. I'm going to do what I can. You know, how can that arise? So as Dharma practitioners, you know, as Steve was talking about, just having that capacity to work with the conditions, we can also, you know, always track what's the shape of the mind right now? Is this shape of the mind leading to more suffering or to more freedom? right? And so often when we recognize that, then we can say, okay, maybe I need to adjust the ingredients in this cake, or, you know, how much of this or that do I add? Do I add more brightness? Do I maybe boil it down to something very simple that I can do? You know, maybe your work around this is to write a letter to a politician and try to persuade them to act in a certain way. You know, so the more we can find that action right in front of us that we can do that, that goes back to that wise action that starts to build that sense of optimism and energy. And then that starts to grow naturally.
Thanks, Tim. That's really helpful.
You're welcome, Kathy. All right, what else is out there?
Would you speak to the wisdom of nature to heal itself and how we can somehow support that?
So around nature healing itself and how can we support that? Well, a lot of it is having that sense of wise discernment. You know, what's really needed here? Because sometimes we just need to step back and let nature do its thing. Sometimes we have to step in and clean up our mess, you know, clean up the harm that we've caused. And so there's kind of that, and sometimes we're kind of powerless, and we just have to cross our fingers and hope things recover in that way. So part of it is that kind of wise discernment about, okay, what's the nature of this damage or this impact, and does nature have its capacity? You know, I think, you know, over time, it, you know, nature will start to rebalance if we're able to stop, you know, acting on it. But that's a lot of it is, you know, we keep causing injury, causing harm. Does that get to your question, or is that?
Oh, that's, thank you.
Yeah, it's that sense of nature healing itself. I might think if we committed in a, you know, in a very deep way, you know, like the same energy we put into going to the moon, for example, on having zero emissions. I mean, that could be something that's the country is completely capable of doing, you know, in 5 years or 10 years or something like that. And certainly the world, if we're willing to just share the technology and support the whole world in that, you know, that's something that could happen. And then once that emissions stop, then nature would start to rebalance. And, you know, some stuff will, there's some damage that's happened that's irreversible. You know, there's species in the ocean are probably not going to come back because of the temperature change, or there's different things have happened, and, you know, nature will evolve over that. But, you know, hopefully we can find that place of unified mind around it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, anyone else like to share anything or ask anything?
Tim, I'm interested in weeds you mentioned as a metaphor for a lot of things in life. Can you put that in context for me? Is it okay to be angry at the weeds as I pull them?
Well, I mean, if you ask that question, it's like that sense of anger toward the weeds, you know, or frustration toward the metaphorical weeds. It's, if you look inside, there's really that, there's a contraction of the heart. It's really harming ourselves as much as the weed is being harmed. Well, maybe not as much, but it's certainly there's harm happening inwardly also. There's a famous sutta called the Simile of the Saw, where the Buddha, you know, is trying to get that point across, that if you have that ill will, you're not practicing what I'm teaching. You're not practicing the Dharma. Even if it feels very justified, it's still not practicing the Dharma. And so the invitation to that sutta, if you, you know, read the entirety of it, he's really talking about that when we're coming for that sense of ill will, we're inherently in that sense of separation. That sense of self is very hardened in that. And he points to how do you have that quality of metta that's not located on that sense of self, that sense of metta or loving kindness that has no bounds, has no separation. And he uses these really powerful similes or analogies of the earth and how vast the earth is or how spacious the sky is to start to teach that quality of metta that is really the opposite of that ill will. So it's not the same as having boundaries. It's not the same about having discernment. But it's, you know, the ill will itself is when that arises, it's really helpful to say, okay, this is an invitation to practice. Let me feel what that ill will, you know, let me take that on and not act from its assumptions. Really, that help, Will?
Yes, thanks.
I think I saw Cheryl, your hand go up.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, the frustration of having watched you know, climate change develop over my lifetime, and the frustration around that, around governments and around the way that we, you know, the whole thing about travel, and I think, you know, back in the early 80s and, you know, in the 70s when we really knew about this, you know. Mm-hmm. It was understood then. I took an environmental studies class in a geology department at the University of Arizona. And it was kind of like what was known then was that the oil companies were basically stifling, you know, mm-hmm. were stifling, research into solar and, you know, everything else. So that took a long time to develop. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and you've kind of, you know, we've seen what our governments have done over the past, you know, since the 80s. And it's just really frustrating to me that as an individual, I do what I can. And the other part is that I think as individuals, we really, really, you know, have to let our leadership know, you know, and en masse, you know, what's right. And it's, you know, that we're not going to buy this stuff that's, you know, causing harm to the environment, that we're no longer going to, you know, support mowing down the arboreal, you know, mm-hmm. Canadian rainforest so that we can wipe our asses. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. And so much. And my difficulty is driving. You know, I have a disabled partner and you know, getting on the bus, and, you know. But I don't do it very much anymore. We only have one car. I have neighbors who have a car for every single person who lives in their house. I mean, it's an interesting dilemma that we live with in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, thank you, Cheryl. It is frustrating. And it's also, I think it's helpful in terms of that, you know, talking about wise discernment. It's like, what's the action that's going to be, that has the most impact, the most meaningful impact? And you talked about, you know, the power of governmental choice and, you know, how, you know, how can you influence, you know, the government? It feels like there's that sense of it's so big and they don't listen to me, but, you know, if there's enough voices, if there's enough skilled voices, I mean, look back to history and all the different major changes of legislation, all often were really led by a few very impassioned people that started to get this level of passion behind it. And so, yeah, that's one way to look at this whole thing is, okay, what's the biggest issue and how can I start to influence that? It may feel like it's just a small influence, but if you get enough of those, it starts to shift and transform it.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Cheryl. All right. Anyone else like to share anything? it's harder to sense the room when you're all in your own houses. It just feels like a little bit, there's some heaviness. There's a sense of like, okay, what to do with this overwhelm. So I don't know if I'm picking that up accurately. So, you know, find that balance that is, you know, talking about with Kathy is, where's that sense of wise effort? You know, is my mind contracting? Because it doesn't help to become overwhelmed and contracted and hopeless. You know, we have to find that sense of brightness, that sense of joy. And that can lead to that quality of impassioned action. You know, sometimes finding the anger, you know, the frustration that Cheryl has talked about, and I know Iris has talked about, that sense of anger, sometimes that's what motivates our actions. So it's, you know, in Buddhism, I think sometimes we get justifiably the criticism that we're too passive, that we just sit there watching our experience. And so how can we start to take that wisdom and compassion into our actions? And climate change is a critical way to do that. All right, so I'm going to just make a couple of quick announcements as we're coming to the end of tonight. So next week, Tweri Salah will be taking over the Monday nights and going to another topic of death, dying, and illness, just to kind of keep the energy going. I'm sure she'll bring a lot of passion to that. And May is lots of offerings. We have a day of mindfulness. I'm connected with the end of the day, intro class on the 15th of May. And so you're welcome to attend that. Also, Narayan is coming to teach a non-residential. So it's going to be on Saturday and Sunday. And Narayan's a very delightful teacher. I've been lucky enough to be able to co-teach with her for the last 5 years or so. And she also taught with Rodney for many years before that. So she's coming, visiting us from Boston area. So please attend that. She's just well worth your energy and time. And then we also have a special ceremony, a Vesak ceremony. This is the day in May that's considered it's celebrating both the birth, the death, and the enlightenment day of the Buddha. And Tweri and I are going to be offering a ceremony on Wednesday, the 26th. We're actually going to do it in the early morning, and that information is on the website. And there'll be an invitation for you to practice some way during that day, you know, around the Buddha's, the celebration of the Buddha. And, you know, offer some suggestions for people who have full-time jobs and have kids, and those who have more, you know, leisure time to maybe practice more in a more formal way. All right. So thank you again for sharing this evening and these last 2 months. And we will see you. We'll see you back in June, if not before. All right. Be well. Thank you for your continued support of the Sims and of the teachers.